artist managers prioritize where they spend money. It's
they'll
fly people from across the world for glam and wardrobe, and then like the audio people and the techs get the short end of the stick, you know.
Even
the musicians too, you know. It's like,
yeah,
you're kind of starting to see a wave of prioritization in the glam and the look more than, you know, the music.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Cloud Machine Podcast. My name is Matt Landry, and in this 72nd episode, I'm here with TJ Rodriguez. Throughout the podcast, we discuss playback, engineering, drumming, the show building process, working on some of the biggest tours in the world, his professional path, living in LA, the music industry, and much, much more. We also play the producer's game. Thanks for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Cloud Machine Podcast, a platform that allows us to learn more about the music industry through conversations with artists, people in the behind the scenes, music business individuals, creatives, and much more. This podcast is brought to you by Eights, a musical direction, playback, and performance company out of Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Our goal with this podcast is to create a resource and library of information on the industry and shine a light on all the stuff that is happening in and around the music world, topics and realities that are gatekept, and the people and roles that may often be overlooked. This week, I have the immense pleasure of welcoming TJ Rodriguez to the podcast. He is a musician, drummer, and playback engineer currently based out of Los Angeles, California. TJ's had the opportunity to work with some industry giants, Camila Cabello, Ava Max, Tinashe, to name a few, and most recently, like right now, including this podcast, he's currently with Sabrina Carpenter. On her recent campaign of world domination, well, it feels like from our end anyway, including, you know, the Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, her MTV VMAs performance, and just so much more. At Eights, we've gotten to know TJ through the industry socials and just simply hanging. We finally met last fall while we were in LA for rehearsals, had dinner, and just connected about a whole bunch of stuff since then as well. Through our conversations, I always thought that he would have lots to chat about on the Cloud Machine Podcast, and just as a, you know, as a guy that is very knowledgeable about all that he is doing. So please, without further ado, welcome TJ Rodriguez to the podcast. Hi, TJ. How are you?
What's up, man? I'm good. How are you, bro?
Good. Thanks for coming on. Where are you coming from today? Where are you at?
I am in London. I'm in London, England right now.
That's right. And not Ontario, not London, Ontario, for those Canadians listening to the podcast. That's great. Are you currently on tour? Is there sort of just a few flyout things?
Yeah, I guess you would consider it a tour. I mean, I'm with Sabrina right now. We did a BBC radio show in London at like the end of May, and then flew to New York and did Govball Festival in New York, and then she just did some promo in Germany. So now we're here in London. We're doing Capital Summertime Ball this weekend. So yeah, it's gonna be great, man.
Fantastic. That's great. Let's start the podcast how we always start the podcast. I wanted to ask you about your favorite live show experience ever as a fan.
As a fan?
Yeah, as a fan.
So that's an interesting question. This is probably going to be non-conventional, but it was probably the first time I ever saw Snarky Puppy in person.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't really a fan of them when I went to the show. A friend of mine who was really into them kind of dragged me to the show in, I think it was in Charlotte, North Carolina. I was living in Atlanta at the time, and he was like, bro, I'll drive the whole way and back if you just go to the show with me. Like, I have an extra ticket. I was like, all right, cool. I didn't really know who they were. So I went, and I literally, at the end of the show, I had to pick my jaw up off the floor. Like, I couldn't believe it. It was just like another level of musicianship that I'd never seen before. And I was definitely a fan after that. I mean, it's like, it's not easy listening music, but it's definitely like, if you need to be inspired, just put on a Snarky Puppy record and just bask. You know what
totally,
I mean?
Totally. And at the time, did they have two drummers, or was it still Sputt, or was it just Larnell?
It was Larnell, and I think they had a percussion player. I don't remember who it was, but obviously yeah. Michael League was still like the head guy playing bass.
Yeah.
I don't think Corey Henry was there, which I was kind of bummed to learn after the fact, because then I saw, like, I went on a tangent, yeah. like a Snarky Puppy rabbit hole, and saw, like, sure. their whole Lingus video with Corey, and
yeah,
realized he wasn't at the show, but I've seen him later in life, and it was unreal, but yeah.
Yeah, it seems like it's sort of like a rotating cast of musicians, basically, except Michael League.
He's pretty much always there. I don't know who could fill in for him.
For sure. He's definitely in that leading role. But it seems like whenever you go to a Snarky Puppy show, it's like you don't know who you're getting, but which is sometimes the magic of it, you know.
It's kind of cool, yeah. It's like no Snarky Puppy experience is the same experience, which is beautiful. Like, it's amazing. Yeah. Yeah,
fantastic. I want to ask you, for those that don't know you, you know, which is oftentimes the fun part of this, about this podcast, is there a project / campaign / era, maybe / tour / show for you that would best represent your work?
Man, I think there's if I had to choose one, it's there is this year, actually, an artist that I work for named Tinashe. She did a headline tour of her new album, which was called BB Angel. And me and my roommate, we had the opportunity to kind of help program the entire show. It was a 90-minute show. And I had a huge hand in the programming process, as far as like in the studio, like messing with arrangements and adding sounds and effects and, you know, set list order, transitions, all that stuff. I think as like a whole show, like if you went to the show, you would hear kind of my influence through that the entirety, you know? Obviously, like, there were other people that played huge parts, you know, my friend DJ, who's like the MD, like, I mean, obviously, I mean, he's the same guy that MD's Doja Cat. Like, he had a huge part. Like, so many different influences played a part in it. But that was probably one of the first times that I've had my hand almost like in the entire show.
Yeah.
Where someone was like, hey, I trust that you can create something really awesome.
Yeah.
And we'll take a listen to it and make sure it's great. And if we need to touch anything, like, you know, edit anything, we will. But like, please, like, we trust like what you hear. So I got to do like the show intro.
Yeah.
I did some dance breaks and transitions. So it's one of those things that like, I like when I saw a video of the show and like went to it for the first time, it kind of hit me. I was like, man, this is crazy. Like, this is my work. You know,
this is you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. You know,
so pretty wild.
Fantastic. For those, and we're going to be talking about it basically for the rest of this podcast, but for those who don't know what programming is, could you take us through what that is?
Yeah, so basically programming is a process that involves adding any musical elements to a show that wasn't already there, that wasn't already a part of the song. So an artist will give us stems for a song, you know, and say, hey, let's say they're doing a TV performance, and they give us stems, they give us, you know, a couple of BGVs, a lead vocal, some drums, some bass, some keys, whatever the original stems are. And they ask for programming, which is basically like, you're going to take those stems and you're going to even add and impose your own elements to it to create a different arrangement. That's different from the record. And it could be like an artist vision, or sometimes they'll say like, I don't really have a direction, just kind of do your thing. So it's you kind of like saying like, oh, maybe I'll take the second verse and I'll kind of flip it and do a different idea. Like, I'll make it go halftime, or I'll give it an R&B vibe or something, or I'll change the progression. I'll add some synths, I'll add some hits, different things like that. So that it's basically, just kind of adding and posing different vibes and sounds that aren't existing already.
That's right. And when you say existing already, for the listener here, it's basically what's existing already from their album.
From the album, what the files that they give you, exactly.
Yeah, so the typical process. Oh, go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, it literally is like, I have the stems in my session in front of me, I have the song, and it could be like I'm playing a Rhodes or I'm playing pads, I'm adding layers to the song that weren't in the files already, or I'm cutting sections, I'm changing the drum patterns, I'm changing chord progressions just to give it a lift, to give it some drama, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is typical for me, and I mean all creative camps, MDs and stuff have like typical things that they would add. Maybe not a typical thing, but maybe even for the listener that's interested, are there some, do you have a couple examples of things that happen a lot, in a different arrangement or a live arrangement, for instance?
I'll tell you what I do all the time.
Sure.
And I think in a couple years when I have gotten my foot really into a lot of arranging and programming,
yeah,
people are going to start to notice.
Sure.
They're going to hear like, oh, that might have been that guy TJ that programmed this. I love there's an impact sample, just a big like a big cinematic impact sample that I got from Splice like 5 years ago that I just use all the time. Like anytime there's a hit in a song or like a break or something, like a big band hit, I add this impact. And I use the same one every time. It's almost like I don't like the way other ones sound. I just use this one all the time. That and like guitar power chords. Like I have like a few samples of just like guitar power chords that I love to just add to beefing up sections. That's kind of like one of my favorite things to do.
And there's something about that, right? I think like somebody needs like when creating a show, it's important to have like a palette that's already settled. And there are so many samples, especially on like platforms like Splice, that at a certain point you need to do a little bit of filtering. You need to have your own kind of sample pack, the TJ sample pack that you can pull from all the time. I'm sure it's gotten much easier throughout the years because you've had all these sounds already. You're like, oh, okay, I like this snare drum sound. I like this impact sound, as you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful, man. Like, I mean, I've grown, I really have. I mean, in my, like on my computer, I have in my Ableton, like in my user library, I have a folder that's just like all of the typical samples that I would just start from like scratch that I would just pull from.
Right.
Like we'll be in rehearsal and I'm running playback and somebody wants to do a flip of an arrangement really quick or add a hit or something. And it's like, oh yeah, let me just drag this in and do it real quick.
Right.
Oh, we'll do it later when we get home. Like, oh, we'll just do it now. I mean, I already have sounds that I can just pull really fast and just get the idea across.
You know? Yeah. Refine it later, but at least
it'll get the idea across now. Yeah.
Fantastic. On the podcast, the Club Machine Podcast, we do a quote segment. Last year, it was Erykah Badu's quote that compared the music art form, music as an art form, to music business and how they were different, how they were the same, how people, guests on the podcast, saw themselves within that balance. This year we have a quote by Joni Mitchell, and this is the quote here. She says, "I heard someone from the music business saying that they are no longer looking for talent. They want people with a certain look and a willingness to cooperate." Now, for context, this is in 2004. And this is not necessarily something that she said, but she heard somebody from the music business saying that they are no longer looking for talent. They want people with a certain look and a willingness to cooperate. And yes, this is 20 years ago. This is one of the reasons why I picked it. So what are the first instincts that you have when you hear this sentence here?
Well, let's see. My very first instinct is I wonder exactly who she heard that from, because that is, if it's somebody from the business, that sounds like somebody who's probably from a record label.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
You know, I mean, honestly, unfortunately, it's becoming more and more true every year. Especially for me, like I see it now all the time. Like, the music industry really is starting to prioritize, I guess you would say, an image of an artist rather than a sound. I mean, I see it all the time, man. Like, people, like fans really care more about what an artist may have wore for a show, like what her wardrobe was, versus like what song was the best. I mean, right. in the age of TikTok, it's all about comments. It's all about like, oh, look at this show that we just saw. You know, it's look how good he or she looked. You know, it's not necessarily about like a good song or she sounded great. He sounded great. It's really like, oh my gosh, she looked so iconic. He looked so iconic, you know?
Yeah.
Slay, it's crazy.
Slay queen stuff.
No, literally. And it's
Yeah.
Even on the inside of the industry, and not to name anybody specific, but I see it all the time where artist managers prioritize where they spend money. It's they'll fly people from across the world for glam and wardrobe, and then like the audio people and the techs get the short end of the stick, you know?
Sure.
Even the musicians too, you know? It's like
you're
kind of starting to see a wave of prioritization in the glam and the look more than, you know, the music in the music industry.
Very interesting. How does that impact or does that impact how y'all are planning the music and the show and the pacing of the show and like things like that? Are there more dance breaks now because people prioritize that, because people want to take their videos out? Are there things like that, you know, prioritize, you know, maybe some more crowd interaction, like things like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of instances where now we have to allot time for, like you said, like dance breaks, wardrobe changes. So we're creating musical instrumentals that necessarily no one really, to be brash, like no one really cares about it, but like something has to happen. So there could be a 3-minute wardrobe change, because that's like the most important part, you know, that there's a wardrobe change to fit this next theme. Yes. And I'm not saying it's not bad. It's awesome. It's just, it's really funny to see like where, you know, in 2004, where that quote came from, like, where was music then, you know? Back in the early 2000s, like you had like Britney Spears and TLC and all of these people who was just like, people wanted to hear the music, you know? And now it's like, we're putting on a show. Like we're putting on a movie, you know what I mean? Content creation, all of the screens, all of the video and lights, it's the wardrobe. I mean, it's a whole theatrical thing now, you know?
Yeah.
So there's definitely a lot of things that we have to do on the programming side to cater to that more than before. Yeah, sure.
Definitely. You mentioned a word that is really interesting to me, themes. In regards to a show, maybe often thought of as acts, you know.
Sure.
And you also mentioned DJ Darian Javon, doing the Doja stuff as well. I found that at the Coachella performance, Doja's Coachella performance, or just oftentimes performances or big performances like that, you have themes or you have acts where it's like, okay, Doja would you know, she's wearing this for these amount of songs, and then it's like this, and then it's maybe a slower part, and then at the end she's in the mud or whatever it is. How is that, are these conversations that y'all have with the creative director, with the artists themselves? Does it always come back to the musical direction team / creative team like that, or is it, you know, are there bigger conversations going on there?
It changes. I mean,
yeah.
Best case scenario, it's very collaborative. Obviously, the artist kind of has the final say, and she or he is the one that kind of lays it out on the line and is like, this is what I'm going for.
Yeah.
I want my team to make it happen. But that's not always the case. Sometimes an artist will say, you know, I have these songs that I want to do. I don't really know thematically what I want to do with them yet. I want to see what your interpretation would be.
Right.
Being if it's from the creative director, from the music director, a lot of times it'd be from the creative director. I mean, people will hire creative directors because of their track record of the shows that they created, you know, the content they created. So
And but not necessarily because of the musical information that's being put out on the shows, but because of the themes, because of the wardrobe, because of the storytelling, exactly. because of all these things. Yeah, totally.
I mean, like a perfect example is, speaking of Doja Cat, at her Coachella performance, there's a song that she did called Demons.
Yes.
And, you know, my buddy Derek Cobbs, he had a huge hand in arranging that song for that show.
Yep.
And the arrangement is absolutely smacking. Like, if you go back and watch it, it is unreal.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, the creative direction, I mean, it's all of these people dressed in like crazy suits of hair.
Yeah, it's like Chewbacca, like, blonde Chewbacca suits for those who haven't seen it.
Yeah. And like the set design, the lights and every, like the choreography was, I mean, it just matched perfectly. So
yeah,
it's like a true testament to, you know, how collaborative the show is. I mean, I don't know specifically for that moment, like who kind of took the reins, but just to see a final product, like, man, that really came together. You know what I mean?
Insane. I want to ask you about talking about, you know, things that we're seeing in the industry. Derek Cobbs, of course, would eventually love to have him on the pod, have a chat. Things that are happening, Coachella, Doja, are there things that you're seeing in the industry that's inspiring you? Or some new developments that you're like, oh, this is cool. People should know more about this.
I have a funny answer to that.
Okay, sure.
With, you know, traveling with Sabrina's camp now, one of my friends who's running monitors for us, he's really into AI.
Yeah.
And funny enough, there is a lot of developments now where AI is gonna become like a new forefront for music.
Yeah, yeah.
Like he was showing me this video of this guy. He had his microphone in his interface, and he was humming a melody into his, you know, into his session, into this plugin.
Yep.
And the plugin within seconds took that humming melody and turned it into a saxophone.
Crazy.
And it sounded amazing.
Right. Was it the sound changing like automatically as a vocal would through autotune, or was it like a recording?
It was real time. Yeah.
Wow. Dang.
So it's like, yeah, I don't remember what the plugin is, but he was singing, and as he was singing, you know, like if you monitored it, it was a saxophone. So
yeah.
Or humming. I mean, there's so many things now with AI. Like, I mean, all of these like YouTube recordings of just random like singers and rappers, like people just create these songs and then they'll put like Drake's voice over
the Drake one. Yeah.
Dude, like I'm telling, like AI is gonna be crazy, and especially if it starts incorporating its way into like video and content, kind of like how Photoshop, you know, you can have an image and you could type in with Photoshop and say like, put this on a, you know, on a riverboat or something. And it like just automatically does it. Like the things you might be able to do with AI with video content for live shows. I mean, it's going to change the game, dude.
Totally. And now even we're seeing it on YouTube, on socials as well, where it's like there's now a sticker that says, okay, this has been modified with AI and stuff like that. Like we're going to see, we're going to see a lot of creative content, music, albums, videos, probably films, movies, whatever, that are going to be created on it. But we're also going to be very aware that they're being created with it. So I think that's interesting as well. We'll get into more of that in a second. But I want to ask you about the origin story. The TJ Rodriguez origin story. Can you give me a lowdown on where you grew up and your creative upbringing, as in family, friends, maybe high school, things like that?
Yeah. So I was born in Orlando, Florida, but I grew up in a really small town in Georgia called Dublin, Georgia. It's about 2 hours south of Atlanta. I grew up there since I was like 6 years old, graduated high school there in 2014. I mean, my graduating class was like 200 people. So it's a pretty small high school.
Oh yeah.
I would say my creative upbringing, is funny because I don't have a single person in my family that plays a musical instrument.
Right.
I think my I think my mom told me at one point that her dad maybe played trombone in high school.
Yeah.
So maybe that played a part in what maybe. I do now. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, who knows? But really for me, like I grew up in church since the time I was a kid, 6 years old.
Yeah.
I played in the youth group, you know, played drums.
Yes. Yeah.
Played in the main sanctuary. Was really bad, but I played, you know.
Sure.
I think there was probably two instances in my life where music really changed for me. When I was in fifth grade, we were able to do auditions for the school band. So I originally was going to try out for saxophone.
There you go.
With don't that know AI? Why. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And my mom was like, why do you want to do that? Like, you've been hitting pots and pans since you were like 3 years old. It seems like you kind of wanted to play drums. And for some reason I was like, I don't know. Saxophone seems fun. She was like, I don't know. I think you're going to maybe wish that you did drums. So the day before the auditions, I was prepared to go in for saxophone.
Wow.
And then I got to the school and I was like, I got to audition for drums. So I did like an easy audition and the director was like, yeah, you got it. You're going to play drums. I was like, nice. Sick, dude. So,
yeah.
I mean, school band was a huge part of what I do now. I mean, I played all through middle school, high school. I was drum captain my senior year. I did band competitions and jazz band and all of that cool stuff. I mean, I remember the high school drum line came to my school in fifth grade, and that's when they were kind of promoting the auditions, and I saw the high school drum line, and it was another one of those like pick up my jaw off the floor moments. Like, I just could not believe that all of these drummers were playing this song together, and it was so sick.
So
that
cool.
That was like a big turning point for me, like that really got me interested in like taking not only just music but drums very seriously at a young age. And then the other, not to be like long-winded, but
no, please.
The other, I mean, this guy who grew up to be my best friend all throughout middle school and high school, even to this day, super close. He showed me the music video to Separate Ways, Worlds Apart by Journey.
Okay.
Because his dad was a drummer, and he had like super like classic rock influence from his dad.
Right.
And I was super sheltered in church growing up. Like, my mom was pretty strict. Like, she really only wanted me to listen to like Christian music. Just, sure. You know, I don't blame her. Like, she wanted me to have a good, you know, a good healthy outlook on the world and not have any bad influences. So, yeah, cool.
Sure.
But my, you know, this friend showed me Journey for the first time, and I heard this song Separate Ways, and there's a part in the song, it's going into the second chorus, Steve Smith, the drummer, there's like a big like band diamond, and he just plays this like crazy fast drum fill, and then it goes into the chorus. And I remember the first time I heard that, I was like, it's game over. I'm doing this for the rest of my life. Like, that's
fantastic.
It was I want to do this. I want to do
this. Yeah, so yeah.
It was from then on out, it was like, okay, music is my life. I don't need to do anything else. Even if I suck at it, I'm just going to do it, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, graduated high school, and I didn't really go to college. I went to a music school in Atlanta. It was like an 11th month program that, funny enough, I didn't finish. I should have, but I didn't, because I luckily was blessed. I started gigging kind of halfway through school. So I didn't finish the school, but I learned a lot. Started gigging from there. That's, you know, kind of where it started.
Yeah. You mentioned when you started talking about high school, you said the high school band is why I'm doing it now, or, you know, it seems like you're drawing a lot of ties to the high school band, even like jazz band, to what you're doing now. Why do you think that is?
It's the camaraderie, man. It's like the
there you go.
It's the it's the making a whole vision happen by like one little piece of music that I'm playing. Like I'm playing this little drum set and I'm playing with these 40 other people and we're making this beautiful song, or it might've not been that beautiful at the time, but but to me it was.
Yeah.
I just loved, you know, the community aspect of it. I loved, you know, I loved like making mistakes with my friends. I loved like correcting those mistakes. I loved like joking around with my friends. I loved like learning all this music and then hearing the final product. I loved going to play at the local country club for some event that our school booked. And then we just played all of these random jazz tunes.
Right.
You know, and it was like, oh man, we're like leaving school early. Like we get like, you know, we don't have to go to fifth period and sixth period. We get to go like play these songs. You know, it's, I was like, oh dude, this is what the music business feels like. You know?
Right. And it seems like you're still doing that, but that country club that you're talking about is now Wembley Stadium.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, wild, but like in regards to like camaraderie and yes, still building, you know, those shows and those tunes with the 40 other people, maybe those 40 people aren't necessarily on stage, but there's definitely 40 people at least behind stage. Oh, and, I wanted to touch on that because I credit my high school experience a lot with, or at least I see the ties all the time between my high school band experience and what I'm doing now. And, I thought that was great. Yeah. Do you remember when things changed professionally for you? Maybe it was, you know, when you were doing that program in Atlanta, maybe it's one sort of similar experience that you had, you know, hearing Steve Smith, playing that Journey song. Do you remember of one experience that really changed your outlook on, okay, I'm going to do this and this is going to be my career. I can pay my bills with this.
Yes. There was one person who really took a chance on me when I was pretty young. Still like he's a big brother mate to this day. He was my roommate. He was the first person in Atlanta that I lived with that wasn't like a family member. So like when I went to school at the music school, I moved in with an aunt and uncle that lived in Atlanta. And then this guy, Benjamin Forehand, one of the best guitar players to this day I've ever heard. Like he is one of the best. He offered me a space in his house for like pretty cheap rent. Cause I was going through some stuff at the time. Like, I like really needed to get out of where I was. And I met him and he kind of saw some potential in me. I met him through church. We were at the same church together. He played guitar. And I think he really saw something in me and he like took me into his house and I paid like cheaper rent than I should have been allowed to pay. But he was just really humble and was like, you know, just, you know, it's not a big deal to me. Like pay me this much and
yeah,
I could stay here and it's not going to be that big of a deal. So he recommended me for a lot of like really cool gigs at the time. Gigs that really like gave me an insight into what it's like to play on the next level, you know?
Yeah.
Cause at this point I was really only playing at church or that kind of environment. Like I was doing a lot of CCM stuff, you know, contemporary Christian music, which is really fun. But at some point, you know, I think there was a longing for me to bring more to the table musically that I just maybe wasn't feeling like was available at the time. And
yeah.
He was the one that kind of helped put me in environments that really I had to think outside the box. And I wasn't necessarily the most qualified in the room anymore, you know? Which was a big big humbling experience for me. So I would say like I credit a lot to him. He challenged me in a lot of ways. I mean, when we were living together, he was like, I want you to learn Off the Wall by Michael Jackson from top to bottom on drums. I want you to transcribe it.
Right.
And I've never had anybody say that, like say anything like that to me. He was like, I want you to transcribe it and then I want to hear you play it. Top to bottom. So I was like, what? So I literally like, I mean, it took me weeks. Like it took me a long time.
Yeah.
And I learned those songs and I set up in the living room and I played those songs from him. He was like, cool. Good stuff, man. Sick. And it was like,
what's next?
Yeah. I was like, what? So having somebody like that just like really challenged me put me in environments that made me uncomfortable, but in a good way. Like it made me grow, you know?
Yeah.
I needed it.
Fantastic. Can you speak to me about moving from Atlanta to LA?
Mm-hmm.
And when that was, what led you to that? Things like that.
Yeah. It was the worst timing of all time. It was during COVID. It's a funny story. So my current roommate who I'm living with, that I've been living with since I lived in LA, Edwin Carranza, amazing MD.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing MD in the industry. I met him in 2020. I was playing Call of Duty with another one of our mutual friends who we spoke about earlier, Derek Cobbs.
Yes. Okay. By the way, this is the craziest story. I've heard this before. Please go ahead. But the Call of Duty tie is hilarious.
It's an insane story. So me and Derek, we were playing Call of Duty during COVID. I mean, maybe 9-10 hours a day. Just what else are we? No one's working. So all we're doing is just playing Call of Duty, collecting unemployment. And one day, probably after like maybe a month or two of playing, he was like, yo, my friend Edwin is going to jump in and play some games with us. It's like, cool. So this guy jumped in, didn't know who he was. I just knew he was a friend of Derek's and we played for hours. And I was in Atlanta at the time. So, you know, for them, like he hopped on probably like 7 p.m. It's 10 p.m. for me on the East Coast. We played until like 1 in the morning and then Derek was like, all right, I'm going to go to bed. 1 a.m. for me. And then Edwin was like, yo, there's this challenge I want to do. Are you going to bed? Are you down to do it? And I was like, yeah, I'm down to check it out. And we played until I got off PlayStation that night at like 10 in the morning. Like him and I played for another like 7 hours, 8 hours.
Crazy.
And from that point, we were like, oh, it's okay. Yeah, you're cool. Like we're going to be cool. So
yeah.
We played for months and got to know each other. And I was doing some like CCM stuff at the time that he was really hip to. And, you know, I was really hip to the LA pop scene that he was doing, you know? So
yeah.
We kind of really hit it off. We had an organic relationship from the get go. Like we didn't really have an agenda from each other. We just were guys who were playing Call of Duty and clicked and had fun. Realized we had similar interests. So,
It's better to have that connection like that, right?
It is, man. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't need anything from you. You don't need anything from me. It was just kind of a random, like, oh yeah, you're super cool. We click in this game. Like, you know, totally. You're a cool dude. And, and then it just kind of happened that, you know, we had mutual interests. Like he really wanted to try to do some more CCM stuff because he grew up in church and loves like playing worship music. And I was doing a lot of that. So I was able to like fly him to Atlanta and to do some crazy opportunities.
Oh yeah.
And then him and I ended up talking and he was like, dude, if you want to come to LA and you're serious about it, like I have a room in my house. Like, why don't you just come move out? And I was like, say less. So I visited LA. I visited his house in October of 2020. And in January I moved and haven't looked back. Like has been a huge pivotal part of like all of the work that I've gotten. So
yeah,
it's been a blessing, man. Like he's one of the bros for life. I've been living with him ever since. And he's on the Sabrina gig with me now. He's the MD, you know. I've gotten so many opportunities with him and met so many cool people. So pretty crazy, man. Yeah, Call of Duty was kind of the caveat.
Crazy. Yeah. Before your relationship, maybe even with Derek and Edwin, were you hip to the term musical director, you know, playback, co-MDing that world kind of thing?
Musical director, yes, because kind of later into my Atlanta CCM life, a lot of the churches I were I was playing at, and like CCM artists I was working for, they all had MDs, and they had guys that were kind of on staff or hired to do, you know, playback in that scene, in the CCM scene, very similar to country music as well. Playback is run from stage. There's not really necessarily a dedicated playback engineer off stage. It's very, the drummer, the keys player has the Ableton session on stage and they're the one that's running it. That's kind of the experience that I had. I was doing a lot of like church Ableton session builds and for random CCM artists, you know.
And this is a maybe it's not a pet peeve of mine, but it's funny to me when you look up musical director on YouTube, it's all CCM stuff that pops up first.
Oh yeah.
It's all
funny because they're the ones that are also just willing to spill all the beans.
that's true. That is,
you know,
true.
What I mean? Which is cool, but yeah, I agree with you. Like when I was first getting into playback for real, like the first videos I was watching was like Elevations playback or
yes.
Or the homie Will Dodgett from studio to stage. It's like, you know what I mean? It's like,
oh man,
this was all I could find. And it was super helpful, but it's like,
no, totally.
This is great for church, but I need to, there's some more answers I need.
All those, you know what I mean? All those church sample packs, the clicks and the cues and all that stuff.
Oh, the
clicks
and cues. Oh yeah. The multitracks.com. You want English or Spanish? Yeah.
Those are crazy. But yeah, no, okay. That makes total sense. But from a pop perspective, then was that your first time being like, holy shit, this is like the real deal kind of thing?
Oh yeah. I mean, my it's really funny, my first gig in LA, I won't say who it was for,
sure,
but my first gig in LA was kind of a playback, a mixing kind of deal. It was like I had to pre-record a vocal for a music, like a live music video shoot, and the artist ended up wanting me to record. Like they were treating it like a vocal session, but we were in the video studio. Like they needed me to record this person's vocal, comp it, tune it, mix it, just so they can have something to lip sync to for the video.
Right.
And they needed it in like 15 or 20 minutes.
Right.
And I went down in flames, like absolutely went down in flames. So that was like my introduction to like LA playback. I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to suck. That's great.
Yeah, it's like you're welcome to the show moment.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but it taught me a lot. Like I there's so many things I would have done different going in. I just wasn't as prepared. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I didn't ask enough questions, you know. So it's pretty funny. Yeah, like I would have handled it so much different if I had to go back in time now. You know what I mean?
Totally. I want to ask you about creative camps that you're part of now in the show building world. I want to ask about, you know, different roles, just in our conversations off the mic, you know, we've had conversations of arranging, you know, producing, programming, musical direction, all the parts that are in a show build. But, you know, the people listening haven't had the opportunity to talk about that. You know, it's often difficult to divide roles as well when you're in a creative camp or when you're in the house with Edwin or something like that. How do you all go about that? And can we talk about like that, the quote unquote hierarchy of a creative camp like that, like who's in that camp and who would be at those sessions?
Yeah. So I will say, when it comes to like building a show, it's very, funny enough, it's handled very remotely.
Yes.
There's so many people involved in that process that goes beyond just like maybe people who you would think are like on the payroll at the camp. It's really like when you're trying to build a big show, there's so many people involved because things have to happen so fast. Like you're not necessarily given 3 months to put a show together. You know what I mean? Sometimes it's like, hey, we have the show in 2 weeks and it's 90 minutes. Like we have to get this going. So it's kind of it's all hands on deck, you know? So I would say it a typical process would be, you know, creative directors kind of give the vibe for what, you know, what we were talking about earlier, themes or acts for a show would be. And it could be like, oh, we're thinking this could be, you know, really dark. It could start, you know, really, really like ambient and mysterious. And then it could just build into a big cinematic epic moment. And then the end of the act is just like, you know, balls to the wall, like the band's rocking out. There's a lot of hits and a lot of band lines, and there's a lot of like dramatic dancing, you know? So
yeah.
It's kind of on us at that point, like Edwin, to kind of help supervise. Okay, we have, let's say, four songs in these acts. I'm going to have two of these guys do a song each that, and kind of give them a direction of like, this is where this song is in that act. This is kind of the vibe that it needs to go.
Right. Because
this is what's going to come before it. And what here's what's going to come after it. Maybe try to achieve this vibe, you know?
Yeah.
And then once like everybody kind of submits their files in, like me and Edwin, you know, it's really helpful for us to sit at home, you know, living together, because we could just go down to the studio and we can look at everything as a big picture, and we'll put it together and we'll say, okay, let's listen to what everything is right now. What do we need to change? Like, are there things we kind of need to reprogram, add to?
Yep.
Is there stuff we need to take out? You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
At that point, it's all these ideas coming together, and how do we make it now a big, like a big picture item that we can give to the artists and the creative directors? Like, here's a reference of this act. Like, what do you think? Give us notes.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
Yeah,
wanted to touch on that, because a lot of the times, you know, especially in smaller camps, a lot of the musical director and that team would do a lot of that. And while, you know, it seems like the further and further up you go, the less and less time the musical director has to be on the ball with all the programming and all the arranging that is happening. Especially, you know, we listened to interviews with homies like Adam Blackstone, for instance, who's at the choreography rehearsals, who's in meetings with artists all the time, but who's handing stuff to Derek Cobbs to arrange out of all the people that he has, things like that. So it seems like the MD is more and more now in 2024. We're seeing that individual being touching a lot of different aspects. Of the show. Why do you think it's important, and why do you think the role is evolving?
I think because obviously the music industry is changing so much. I mean,
yep.
For somebody like Sabrina, for example, she's in a huge spotlight right now. I mean, yes. she's dropped two really big songs in the last couple of months. So
yeah.
There's so many shows that are happening now that have just been added, that it's like, you know, somebody like Edwin, he doesn't have enough time to physically sit down himself and program all of this stuff. I mean,
right.
Just in the last like 2 weeks, I mean, we've done different versions of our show, and, you know, she's wanting different intros, she's wanting different transitions, different versions of the set list. And then at the same time, we have a promo show that we're flying to, and that's a completely different arrangement of a song. I mean, it's just, it's one of those things. It's like, it's impossible for one person to do this by themselves, you know?
Yeah.
The role is kind of evolving now to where there's so many things happening for an artist at one time because of the age of social media. Like, people are blowing up so fast.
Right.
And everything is documented online. So like, it's literally all hands on deck to make sure that every single performance that's happening or whatever is like 100% the best that it can be.
Totally.
And one person can't always do that by themselves. Like, if you would be up all night for 3 days trying to like make perfect arrangements for every single, you know, every single promo show that's happening, or every single 90 minute set that you're slotted to for a festival. You know, it's kind of hard. So the MD role is evolving to where it's like, you're starting to kind of put people in places that you trust that can deliver you a product that you know is going to be right. You know? And in our case, like, we're lucky to have some really good arrangers and programmers on our side that it's like, you don't really have to tell them much. They get what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And you maybe have to like adjust a couple of things just because we're on the inside and know what the artist likes. But for the most part, it's like, dude, this is kind of the vibe I need help with. You know, I'm working on this other thing. You know, we want to do this. Can you, you know, can you help us out? And it's great. So it's like, yeah, so many things happening, especially in like in our case. I mean, we're working with multiple artists at one time. So
yep.
It's that, but with like two other artists at the same time. So it's just like, you know, we want to be willing and available to do it all, but it's obviously it's a huge team effort, you know? So, totally. MDs now are just a really good, like, business people. They're really good supervisors. They're good at like getting a vision done in whatever means necessary. And somebody like Edwin's a great example. Like, he, super humble, and he doesn't even have to touch it himself if he doesn't feel like he needs to, if he has other people in place that he thinks will do a great job. And he's just there to make sure the artist knows that, like, we did everything we could to make sure that it was the best, and they hear it and they're like, we love it. Then cool.
Yeah, there you go. This is a very nerdy question. How do y'all typically move sessions from one arranger or programmer back to you and back to them and stuff like that, typically, just from a logistics standpoint?
Kind of depends.
I
would say we try to make sure, at least for all of our arrangers, we're still in this building process, but
yeah,
we're all trying to be on the same version of Ableton Live.
Yeah.
So that way, like, when we're sending like, it'll normally start with, if there's a song, you know, let's say for Tinashe or something that needs to get arranged, I'll put the stems in a session, in an organized session, all of the stems in there. I'll put the song section markers. I'll do all the tempo mapping.
Sure.
And if there's any sort of like little programming that Edwin has me do, or whoever has me do, to kind of help facilitate the vibe,
yeah,
I'll do, and I'll upload that to Dropbox, and I'll send the session to whoever, you know, let's say Derek.
Yep.
He gets the session, he'll create a save as, and he'll do what he needs to do, and then he'll upload it back to Dropbox and send it back over.
Yeah, totally. You know? Just an ALS file, basically.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he's uploading the same session again, but just with his, if we're on version 1.0 of the session, his, like, whatever he did to it is 1.1, and he'll upload it to Dropbox and send it back, and
then
we'll do what we need to do, you know? So
Fantastic.
It's really important. I think for us in our workflow, we've noticed like, for all of us to kind of be on the same version of whatever DAW that we're working on. So that way it's just easy to send stuff and download. Cause with Ableton, and I'm sure you know this, if on like a slightly different, like if you're on 11.2 and somebody else is on 11.3, it's like, well, there went that.
Well, and sometimes you can't even open the session, right?
Right.
Because it's an earlier or later version of it. So
which
you can go one way, but you can't go back the other.
Which I'm going to give your whole podcast a secret weapon right now. There's a website called Jukebox where you can actually upload ALS files, and you can down convert Ableton sessions if you pay a monthly subscription. So
fantastic.
That's a secret weapon I've been telling people about, dude, because I've been working with a lot of artists where I've had to do like session builds or session cleanups where I get it. I work in 11.2 of Ableton. That's what I love.
Yeah.
But I'll get like versions of Ableton 11.3 and it's like, I can't open this. Well, with Jukebox, you can literally drag the ALS file into there and it'll down convert it to Ableton 10. And obviously it's a lower version, so you can open it in Ableton 11.2. So it like totally solved the problem.
Yeah, this is the Jukebox ad right now. This is an ad segment of the podcast.
Oh yeah, where's my payout, Jukebox?
Yeah, with Jukebox you can finally
Yeah, right.
I like that.
It's a sick platform, man. Yeah.
That's great. I'll check it out. There's one thing. we talk about all the time. Maybe I have nightmares about it. Maybe I don't. Well, maybe we can talk about that off mic.
Sounds like you do.
There's an infamous, maybe not infamous, it's just maybe because I'm such a nerd about musical directing. But there's this famous Adam Blackstone story that he tells a few times where he's walking up to the stage with Kanye, and Kanye was like, "Hey man, in that song tonight, I don't want to do verse two." And then he goes on stage.
Yeah.
Maybe the question's not necessarily that, but how do y'all figure out like modifications and different arrangements of the song on tours? You said that y'all are also juggling different arrangements of the song, whether let's say Sabrina's doing a TV performance or she's doing a live tour or she's doing like a radio thing where it's almost just the recording, the song arrangement that people have heard just on the radio, mm-hmm. or on Apple Music or whatever. How do you sort of go about those modifications and those different arrangements? Not even just in the camp, but also with the musicians as well, learning a whole bunch of stuff and like things like that.
That's a really good question. So at the end of the day, I'm the person with all the files. So it's a huge pressure.
Yeah.
I've been doing this kind of playback thing for real for like 3.5 years. I mean, I'm still learning, but I've had to hone in how to be organized. I mean, right now in my backpack, I have 7 hard drives that I carry with me that I use every day. I mean, I literally have like hard drives just allotted for an artist. Like, oh, this is my Sabrina hard drive.
Right. It's like 2 terabytes.
Were you it's more? Like, it's like 4. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, exactly.
I'm pretty old school. So like I have a notebook in my backpack that I literally write like, okay, what show is this?
Yeah.
What's the session name? What's the song? What's the arrangement? And I look at this and I'm like, okay, this is what I have to do today. It's important that on my hard drives, it's always external hard drives. I don't keep anything on my computer because I just need one place that everything is in. So like I can open it and it's like, okay, everything that I have to worry about is right here.
But during one show, you're not necessarily going between sessions. You're just before the show, you're organizing your one session for that show, basically. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Every show has its own session. I mean, but that's a thing though, like a funny Kanye story. Like I've done shows with artists where it's like, oh, you know what? She actually wants to add this verse because the artist that was the feature on the verse is here tonight and they're going to sing the verse. So it's like, okay, cool. It's like an hour before the show. So now I'm having to like pull these stems and I'm having to make, you know, drag the stems in, add time, totally. Add the verse, make sure that it's all in line. I mean, yeah, it's a big thing. I mean, being organized is very important. You know, you kind of have to be on your toes and ready for anything, you know? So, yeah.
Fantastic. Wanted to ask you about a few things here about industry, community, things like that. Might be an interesting question. How do y'all keep your cards close while also taking a look at what other MDs and what other creative camps are doing in the industry? Because, I'm in these shoes in regards to. I'm inspired by so many people, but it's hard to be like, okay, I'm going to just get to take this now, take that. Obviously there's a reality to it. Music's all aspects of music have been done, quote unquote. But how do y'all keep your cards close? But also stay at the forefront of the industry.
So this is probably not an answer that kind of that maybe whoever's listening is going to love.
Yep.
This is going to be an answer that kind of shows the testament of like brotherhood that we have, like in the group of people that we work with. We're very blessed that in the circle of friends that we have that are kind of music directors, playback, musicians, we're all on the same gigs. Like,
yeah.
I mean, seriously, like,
yeah,
you know, somebody like Darian Javon,
yeah,
he's the MD for Doja Cat, but like somebody like Edwin doesn't necessarily play bass for Doja, but he helps arrange songs. Derek, you know, he helps arrange songs.
Yep.
Or like, you know, somebody like Derek isn't on the gig with Sabrina, but he helps arrange songs. Or like with Charlie, like somebody will help arrange a Charlie Puth song. Or
yep,
like, you know, DJ will send me a Doja session and it's like, hey, kind of in a pinch, really need help, like kind of cleaning this session up. You know, we're really blessed that like in everybody's gigs that we're friends with, like everyone kind of gets the opportunity to like dip their foot in everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's funny, like even in scenarios where like one of our friends got let go from a gig, another one of our friends got hired, and then that friend hired the person that got let go to like do programming or something. So it's like,
we're
blessed that like, you know,
y'all are looking out for each other, for sure.
Yeah, everybody's looking out for each other. It's kind of like, yeah, we work for the artist, but at the same time, we're looking out for the well-being of our friends. So,
yep.
I mean, maybe for like the general person, I think it's important. I think it's important to not be somebody who tries to hide all your secrets. And I also think it's important, like when you approach people, like looking for answers, like if you're somebody who's like really trying to seek knowledge,
yep,
really assess where that's coming from, you know?
Yeah.
I think intentions have a big part in the music industry. People can, I mean, sadly, like people can weed out bad intentions really easy. And I think it's important that, like, if you're somebody who's wanting to become a music director one day and you don't really know the steps to take, like there are people who are willing to like, to be on your side and help.
Yeah.
But you know, at what cost? I think it's important, you know, it's like,
yeah, there's also people willing to skip steps as well, right?
Yeah. I mean,
and take over roles, take over opportunities for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, you just have to kind of be willing to do what it takes, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's really, yeah, that's really important. But like I said, we're in our friend group, we're really blessed. I mean, it's not really one of those things where we have to keep our cards super close because we're all kind of destined to work with each other in different shapes, you know,
which is totally
really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's great. How do live shows stand out in today's industry? Very general question.
Yeah. Oh man, that's a tough one. How do live shows stand out? I mean, whatever blows up on TikTok.
Sure.
That's the easy answer. I mean, yeah, dude, man.
It's unfortunate, like, but it's the reality.
It is, but it's like if you're scrolling Instagram Reels or TikTok and all you like, you scroll every other video and it's like a live show of, you know, Doja Cat or Tate McRae or Sabrina. It's like, that's how a live show stands out, when the internet is literally losing their minds over some moment.
Yeah.
That's how you know a live show stands out. I mean, seriously, like that is, I mean, the amount of times from artists that we get sent videos like, oh my gosh, this was so amazing. Or this was really bad. Like we can't have this happen again. It's literally like TikTok videos.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's, well, like, okay.
It's because how else are they supposed to get their references from? Right.
Exactly. So,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, I would say, yeah. How does a live show stand out? How did it do on TikTok? That's the that's the answer.
That's the thing. Well, it's like, how do you evaluate it? It's because the audience is there commenting on it and being like, okay, commenting on it enough so that other artists see it and be like, hey, this worked. You know?
Oh yeah.
The Chapel Roan Statue of Liberty thing. I'm sure you saw that.
Oh yeah. We were there for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Absolutely insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like, it blew up, man. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah. Yeah.
That's how you know a show did well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great answer. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a few more questions before we wrap it up. Just generally for the people listening, how could one grow their prospect in the business, as in get to the next step? Or, you know, is it truly all patience connections and experience, or are there things that people can do to, you know, get to the next step?
Yeah. I would say the industry is definitely a lot about who you know.
Yep.
But I would also say, I mean, we're in the age of social media where there are a lot of people getting gigs based off the content that they post. I mean,
yeah.
I have a buddy who's playing for Janet Jackson now, and he's been posting videos on YouTube and Instagram for a long time, and they've been amazing. And you know, the guy that hired him for the gig was like really into the stuff that he was posting, and they met, and I mean, long story short, he got the gig, you know, like,
yes. It's that he saw the content, he saw the portfolio online, then met the lad, then the connection was there, and that's yep. Game over. Once you got the portfolio up and you're a good person, then
yeah, I mean,
and that's what it is, really. Yeah,
I would say, like, it's really important to, in the age of social media, to create a what am I trying to say? A relatable but also like impressive online platform.
Yeah.
That's really big. I mean, all the time, like, I hear MDs looking for musicians based off like social media presence. Totally. It's like, who's like, people aren't really doing auditions anymore. It's very much like, oh yeah, there's this dude I saw on Instagram, or, you know, this girl sang really well on Instagram. She'd probably be a good background singer. And they're sending these Instagrams to these artists, and these artists are reviewing these Instagram posts. You know what I mean? So
literally. It's,
no, like, it, I see it all the time. Like, I'm seeing it all the time. I would say, like, a strong social media platform, even if you don't have a lot of followers. That's not what I mean. I just mean, like, your content is really consistent. It's good. It's relatable. And you're somebody who's really approachable. You're not somebody who, like, tries not to answer DMs because it's like the cool thing to do. It's like, no, people appreciate transparency. People appreciate, like, communication and being able to relate with what you're doing. And just, yeah, not take yourself too seriously, you know, like, be available for, even if somebody asks you for a dumb gig, just take it. Like, you never know what that's going to lead to, you know?
Totally.
I think that's a big thing. Like, never think you're, like, too good for something. Because you'll never know. Like, there's been so many gigs that I've done that I thought were dumb. And they, like, I met somebody who kind of really was a big part of what I do now, you know?
That's right. Everything leads to everything, really.
It is, yeah.
Or at least something.
Yeah. Everything leads to everything.
Yeah. Fantastic. Just a few personal but general questions. What are you looking forward to right now?
What am I looking forward to?
Except being in your bed. Back in LA.
Being in my bed, playing Call of Duty again.
Yeah.
I haven't played Call of Duty in several weeks. I'm looking forward to seeing my mom. I haven't seen my mom in a few months. So getting back to Georgia is gonna be great.
Any plans there to get back to Georgia?
I'm gonna try to go like kind of the second week of July. I'm doing once I get back from this run, I have like a week off, and then I do a quick little Europe run with Tinashe, and then I think after that I'll be able to go home for a little bit, so see my mom.
Yeah.
I would say that's what I'm looking forward to the most. Like, the older I get, I'm just like, man, I gotta go home and see my mom some more, you know.
That's great. Same here.
Yeah.
And what's the dream? And are you living it now? side question.
I am living what I thought my dream was maybe 5 years ago.
There you go.
I feel like every, like, 5 years I have a different dream. I would say the dream now is, I would love to be in a place where, like, I own my own home.
Yep.
I can support, like, help support my mom and stepdad where they live. Like, they don't have to worry about finances so much, that I can be in a place where I can, you know, freely help them live. I mean, yeah, where they don't have to worry about finances so much. I mean, that's like a huge dream of mine. I want to put my mom in a house. That's her dream. I want her to, like, take vacations. I want her to retire early, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful, man.
Yeah.
Great.
Pretty sad. And
No. It's a great dream. It's a great dream.
Yeah. And also to play music at the highest level, but that's like,
there you go. Yeah, recently on the pod, I've asked, like, are there some venues that you haven't been able to do yet, venues, festivals, things like that, that you're maybe aren't in the cards yet, but that you'd love to do, or that you've always set your eyes on.
Yep, I still to this day haven't done Red Rocks.
Oh yeah,
I really want to do Red Rocks.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to Red Rocks before. I've never played it. I have friends that have done it, and they're like, dude, it's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And I'm just so jealous. I want to do Red Rocks so bad.
Yeah. Yeah. One of our clients just did Red Rocks a few weeks ago. We weren't there, but the pictures and the videos, it was amazing. And it crossed like a big check mark off of their bucket list.
So, who was it?
The Beaches.
Oh, the Beaches did it. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. With Girl in Red.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was great.
Super cool.
Cool, man. I would love to wrap up with the producer's game. Which is a game that we play for the listeners. Maybe it's your first episode. Hopefully it's not your last episode that you listen to the Cloud Machine podcast. We play a few games on the podcast. This week I want to do the producer's game with TJ, basically asking our guest if they were to sit on an executive producer in the executive producer's chair for an album of their dreams, what would this album look and sound like? And this is a dead or alive, people. So basically asking TJ this week about this album, who the artist would be, as in, you know, who would put it out, the producers on the album, who would be in the band, for the record, the studio and the city, as in you could bring Abbey Road to New York, for instance. As in the studio and the city, it doesn't necessarily need to be in the same. This the city doesn't need to be, you know,
in the same place in the studio. Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. The era, as in which decade this album would be put out, and then for you, I would say the special question is how would you do the first? How would you do the show? How would you do the first live show? So,
oh man, what a loaded question.
A big loaded question.
Okay. So yeah. The artist, let me start with the artist. I think the artist would be Michael Jackson.
There you go. Yeah.
And then the next was what, the producer?
Producers, yeah.
I think it'd be crazy to hear Max Martin produce Michael Jackson.
There you go.
I think that would be absolutely insane.
Yeah. Any other, you know, you could add people to this as well. You could multiple producers, maybe even a few artists, maybe some features or something.
Ooh. Maybe like, I think you should throw Quincy Jones in there. I think Quincy should be there.
Sure.
To have Max Martin and Quincy worked. So, I mean, because Quincy knows Michael, but then to have like Max Martin's influence in there at the same time.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be the craziest thing you've ever heard, probably. And then, well, it was the studio.
Yeah. Well, the band. Who would be in the band?
Oh man. Who would be in the band? Jeff Beccaro on drums.
Okay, perfect.
This is totally random. Like this would.
No, of course, just a dream album.
Yeah, Jeff Beccaro on drums. It'd be. Probably Pino on bass.
Oh.
Let's see. I would put Greg Fillinganes on keys. I mean, he's like one of the greatest of all time. So who we got? Jeff Beccaro. We've got
Pino filling Pino gains.
And filling gains. And then who would play guitar? Maybe Steve Lukather, actually.
Well, the,
there like you go. Jeff was, and Steve Lukather.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be kind of crazy.
Insane.
That'd be a crazy band. So you have keys, bass, guitar, and drums.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you have Michael, Max Martin, and Quincy.
Who would be the MD?
And then this. Oh my gosh.
MD.
Who would be the MD? Maybe Blackstone, dude. That could be kind of crazy.
There you go.
If it was like a more modern, like 2014 kind of Max Martin era.
Yeah.
Blackstone, like doing the JT Super tour, Bowl. Like that. Yeah. Like that kind of vibe. And then you had like Picaro and Pino, Phila Gaines and Steve Lukather. They just play. Oh man. That'd be the craziest project you've ever heard.
Yeah. Studio City, for the record.
Probably Ocean Way in LA.
It would stay in LA?
I think it would stay in LA. I think it has to.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had to pick it up, if I had a crane to move the studio, I'd do it somewhere like random, like Alaska or something. Just because why not?
Alaska. That's great. Okay, well, that's fantastic. And how would you do the live show? Would it be Adam Blackstone 2014 era Super Bowl, like that vibe, or?
Yeah, it would probably be like, I would imagine they would probably hire an orchestra. So it'd be that same band with Adam MDing and then like a random orchestra. Yeah, at Madison Square Garden or something. That'd be the there first show.
Fantastic.
And I don't know how that first show would go. It would make headlines.
Fantastic.
AI will probably at some point make that happen.
That's right. The Welcome Back Michael Jackson tour with Pino on bass.
With Pino on bass, yep. Exactly.
Cool, man. Well, that's how we wrap up this week's podcast. Thank you for being on. It was just so insightful to get to know a little bit more about your process, about the camps that you're working with right now, without necessarily, you know, giving away all the secrets.
Right.
But thanks for coming by, man.
Dude, yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I mean, huge honor. Like, so much fun. Always good talking.
Yeah, always great. For the people at home listening or even watching on YouTube, please visit and follow TJ on social. That's T-Rod on drums on Instagram to keep up to date with what he's got going on in London right now, but traveling the world with some of probably your favorite artists. So stoked about that. I also want to thank those who have been listening to the Cloud Machine podcast. Yes, it is the 72nd episode. So we were keeping on going here, folks. We love to keep this platform as interactive as it can be. So please keep commenting, leave your comment if you haven't before, your questions, and reviews below. If you're on Spotify, Apple Podcast, things like that, you can, leave your review below if you'd like to. That would really help us here at Eights. And of course, please don't hesitate to subscribe to get our notifications and to keep up to date with what's going on in the industry. We don't do this for us. We do this to share the knowledge of the industry because we believe it's so gatekept. There's not a lot of information on roles in the industry, especially roles that that TJ has right now. Like playback, like MDing. So we're just trying to build this library of resources and information for y'all, and you know, sometimes for us as well. We're always learning. So please, everybody, keep in touch, and thanks, TJ, again.
Yeah, thanks, man.